Welcome to the first Eye on the Peninsula current affairs program on RPP FM local radio. Good afternoon, I'm Piers Cunningham. Ahead of today's program, we look at what transpired from the AFL Southeast launch and AGM, what a local community feel about their safety and security after the latest terrorist attack in Belgium, Australian volunteer Coast Guard in talks with the government over funding and safety, paramedic assaults are on the rise, the launch of a local produce certified trademark, what does it mean to local farmers and communities, and Bryars Ward Councillor's community meeting update. But first, Redhill Consolidated School has been hit with a gastroenteritis virus, sending about 40% of staff and about 180 students home with the illness. The Department of Health and Human Services is working with the school, the Mornington Peninsula Shire and the Department of Education and Training to investigate and respond to the outbreak. Some locals are expressing concern about the virus and lack of monitoring, suggesting that low water levels in tanks at the school and in the area should be investigated as a possible cause. Many Redhill residents are calling for deliveries of fresh water. Redhill Consolidated School Principal Leanne Marshall and Vice President Benjamin Clapp were not available for comment. However, Ms. Marshall did tell the Age newspaper late last week that it was an extremely unfortunate situation to happen just before the Easter holidays. Ms. Marshall said closing the school a day before the Easter break was a responsible decision. She sought to assure the community the school was working with the Department of Human Services to find out the cause of the virus. A Frankston Hospital spokeswoman said four patients with gastro had been admitted to the paediatric ward last week. Concerned parents should seek medical advice. Once authorities are satisfied there is no further risk, the school will communicate with the community to confirm arrangements for the normal commencement of school after the holidays. We will have a full report on the outcome of the investigation once complete. The launch of the Mornington Peninsula Netball Football League got off to a fiery start at the Mornington Racing Club before Easter. Local club officials are still worried about the state of the competition following the resignation of the previous board. Deborah Maher reports.
Club officials across the peninsula turned out in numbers to hear the new board assure them that the game is in good hands. Chair of AFL Southeast, Mr. Roger Hampson, declared the league had the business model to turn league affairs around in a new era of transparency.
The league came to us in June last year and expressed its concerns about the then administration of the league and the board. They had concerns about it, but the previous AGM that they were unable to furnish timely financial results. And then as in the first half of the season, they had greater concerns. And then basically, you have to say it was a vote of no confidence in the previous board. They stepped down and the AFL South East Commission was asked to come in to in caretaker governance, which we have done.
A special AGM was called last December, bringing about the following changes to the new layer of governance. Mr. Hampson was confident by the end of the financial year, clubs will be in a stable position after the previous board ran at a loss of over $200,000.
In December, we had a special AGM, which basically they've given the governance across to AFL South East Commission formally. From there, basically what we've done is reorganise the constitution, the governance of the league. We've made new appointments, rationalised the staff in the office, brought other schools in from other areas which the commission has been able to do. And what we're trying to do is establish best business practices so that the football on the peninsula will flourish. It's going to be tight this year, but I think that we've got a budgeting for a modest surplus. The league does have capital assets, which we do not wish to liquidate at this stage. It would be a bit premature. But a large number of leagues in other areas do not have any capital assets, and they run, put it bluntly, on a borderline budget each year and are still very successful. So you might say in a cash flow situation, it has been tight. It will be tight in the first part of the year, but I believe by the end of the year, the league will be in a pretty good financial position.
Mr. Hampson understands people on the peninsula are passionate about their football, concluding...
Every year it's great to see changes in coaches, numbers of players. Tyab, who have been down the cellar dwellers, have recruited very well, and now that they are very have numbers for first and seconds, which is really viable, makes them very viable. What we want to see is the lowest common denominator in any league on the way up, so that it's a competition where your win-loss ratios are closer every week, and it's more enjoyable for the the people who go to football. And people here on the peninsula love their football, and we just want to make it as entertaining for them.
During the evening, Region General Manager Jeremy Burke talked about local football and what it means to the community.
We've got one of the most proudest, successful, historically significant regions in Victoria. You know, football's been played here for over 100 years, over 120 years. The clubs are all very strong and dynamic in their own right, have very good community support, community engagement. So we're about making sure, and I suppose what it comes back to is we're all about the club, and we're to make sure that sustainability of the club is at the forefront of our thinking.
Jeremy comes to the role with a Country New South Wales football background. He played and coached at country, metro and amateur level and understands the dynamics and idiosyncrasies of each particular aspect of our sport.
This governance restructure and admin structure is about providing more resources at the disposal of the clubs, having stronger skill sets which are able to support the clubs in what they're trying to do, and less focus on the leagues. You know, we're focused on the clubs. We can start a league overnight, we can't start a club overnight.
And lastly, newly appointed Peninsula Leagues manager Sean Connell was excited about his role and is excited to be part of the new layer of governance.
Yeah, it's an exciting new role, working across both junior and senior footy along the peninsula, so looking after their PNFL and also Frankston and District Junior Football League. Yeah, I think the exciting thing about the role is being able to work with the operational staff across the existing leagues and really work on establishing some, best practice protocols right across the network. And it also brings both junior and senior footy together in a more collaborative approach than what we've probably seen over the last few years. I guess from my perspective, it's just around working closely with the people at grassroots and empowering them to really make their clubs as good as they can be.
Deborah Maher reporting from the launch of the new AFL Southeast governing body. The Mornington Peninsula Netball Football League season commenced Good Friday with arch-rivals Rosebud and Rye settling the score with a draw in the RPPFM Match of the Day. Proudly sponsored by Rye Dramana and Rosebud Bendigo Bank community branches. Europe was rocked again last week with the terrorist attack on Belgium. Although we are geographically a long way from Brussels, people on the peninsula have been deeply moved by the tragedy. Could a similar attack happen here? Mount Eliza Village community share their thoughts with Jessica Swan.
Do you feel your personal security and safety has been compromised with this latest attack in Brussels?
Even though we're miles and miles away, I do feel that, you know, I mean, let's face it, there are fanatics everywhere that don't think. My mother was brought up in Antwerp, and I have relations over there. Before I know, one of them died in that. I just can't believe that these people can get away with it and then sit back and enjoy the publicity of being able to say, oh, we did that, we're responsible for that, for the killing of innocent people. Mm-hmm. That is gutless, it's woeful, it's just beyond my belief. And I'm so lucky that we're in a wonderful country like this. But then it can happen. Who knows? Who knows? They're concentrating on Europe. Next stop, 10 years' time, could be Australia. Who knows?
One thing I do think, we could expect the same thing of our own door any time. Mm-hmm. That's what really makes you think. It brings me back to Ireland days, you know, where in Ireland for the IRA were blowing people up here,
so
there.
So were you in Ireland at the time when the IRA was
in? We were in Ireland when the bombs could go off anywhere. No, it's just horrible to think, because when you're living here, it's nice and quiet and you think the world is... everything's going lovely, but when you hear that, no, it's frightening.
We're geographically so blessed, we're so far away from this, but I think it is striking a chord in the hearts and minds of people living on the peninsula. Does it affect you in that same way?
Well, look, it does in a way, because I have a son who's a policeman, so I hear a lot of what goes on. So yeah, it does. I mean, you're always weary, aren't you, of suspicious things. I mean, I don't think that we're really in the firing line, but we don't really know, do we?
My name's Louise, and it was shocking that it had happened yet again. So we had all the Paris upheaval last year, and it was now in Brussels. I think when I saw the newspapers this morning, that really brought it. It was right in your face. I think it's very conflicting for people like immigrants, like myself, who came from a country that was we were seen as having terrorists in our country.
In South Africa.
I think one's got to be very careful when you use the word terrorism and how you actually brand people. And, you know, the fact that these people are seen as Muslims and ISIS, you need to be very careful about what you actually mean by Muslims, and that we don't brand people in our own country that way. So that's very concerning for me, the response that the majority have towards a minority in their own country.
And you're also here with your son.
I know the stuff that it has been going on in Europe, and it's really quite sad how we as a country are handling it as well, because I don't notice that we're putting in an effort to help out around like those sort of issues with terrorism in other countries. And we're also not educating people like my age about the effects of terrorism and everything about terrorism, but also not every Muslim is a terrorist.
Absolutely. And how old are you?
I am 14.
And when you were at school today, did you find that people were talking about this at all?
I heard some comments, yeah.
You've got your whole life ahead of you. You've probably got ideas, aspirations, dreams about what you want to do and what you want to be, and probably part of that is to travel the world and live overseas for a period of time. Yeah. What kind of world are you moving into?
I don't think this will affect, because I think we can come together as the whole world, and we can fix this problem. So I'm not worried.
You know, in terms of how and what the answer is, I couldn't honestly say, but it's just, it's heartbreaking. It really is. And safety-wise, from a safety point of view, I travel to and from the UK probably twice a year. And it has changed my perspective a little. You know, how safe is it? Or please, you know, please don't let it happen again. But, you know, you just wonder if and when.
The fact that it's overseas means nothing. It can happen anywhere. That's how I felt. And then you sort of think, when does it ever stop? I mean, I've got a son that's in Europe at the moment, and he's travelling.
As a mum with three children under eight, when you turn the news on, do you worry about how to explain these things to your children?
Of course I do. They just don't understand. They just see people killing each other and just don't understand why people do that to each other.
That was Jessica Swan speaking with the Mount Eliza community. This summer, there have been a number of emergencies on our peninsula waters. The Australian Volunteer Coast Guard says lack of funding and resources has made their task more difficult. To find out more, Amy Henson spoke with Richard Burgess, Volunteer Coast Guard Squadron Board Advisor.
Why has the Australian Volunteer Coast Guard and Boating Industry Association supported a review of the current structure of the marine safety activities in Victoria?
Okay, so in September 2014, the recommendations from the Marine Rescue Inquiry were handed down by the committee. There were 43 recommendations. Consistent with our submission was the formation of a single entity. Now, what was handed down to Parliament on the 11th of February didn't reflect what we believed would be in the best interest of the volunteers in marine rescue. It was more the formation of a number of committees. We didn't believe that that would provide the right governance model, bring marine rescue into the future. So we had the opportunity to meet with the Minister for Emergency Services, Jane Garrett, and Emergency Management Commissioner, Craig Lapsley. And at that meeting, we expressed our concerns about the governance model, and they took that on board, and we've basically given the government, they've requested an 8-week period to review our concerns, and we'll be waiting on what the outcome of that is.
Are you able just to elaborate a bit about your concerns?
Well, what we actually did was our submission was based essentially on the New South Wales Marine Rescue model, which, like Victoria, prior to that organisation being established, was marine rescue in the state was provided by a number of volunteer associations in the state of New South Wales. And they also had a review. This was some 6 years ago. And it was established that the ideal means of providing the right governance model was to establish a single entity that has all the protections that a emergency service agency requires, very much like the conditions that CFA volunteers and SES volunteers conduct their operations under.
How How do you think that this will affect the volunteers if it's not reviewed in the way that you put forward?
If the right governance model isn't established, then we can't see how the government can provide the right level of not only recurrent funding to cover costs of maintenance and insurance, but also the establishment of a capital program that ensures that we are provided with right vessels that are fit for purpose for the job. Continuing to manage under a number of associations is the Water Police, in their submission, have openly admitted that it's not the ideal way of managing the volunteers. And given that we've got a best practice model in New South Wales, we believe that that's where we should be heading.
And how do you think this will affect the local community?
Well, the local communities are very important, obviously. And I know your radio station, you're broadcasting probably along the Mornington Peninsula, but for the flotilla that I belong to in Gippsland, which is the Port Albert flotilla, we have a very small population, yet it is a very busy port. The flotilla is very busy. They operate a 3100 Noosacat, very much on the same lines as the Volunteer Marine Rescue Unit at Mornington. It's very costly to maintain those vessels. The insurance costs are high. At the moment, the only means of attracting funding is to conduct raffles in the local community. And, of course, in small communities, that's quite challenging, particularly when there are other worthy charities that we're competing against.
Is there any other points that you'd like to raise about this issue?
One of the important things is that over the last 10 years, the growth in recreational boating has gone from numbers from about 100,000 registered boats to now Transport Safety Maritime are reporting 190,000. And you can see that that what this represents is a direct demand on the services of both Water Police but also the volunteers. It's nothing for some of the marine rescue volunteers there to be attending to requests for assistance from vessels four or five times a day. Now, when you consider that there is a trend that some of these assists are starting to occur outside weekends, you've got volunteers that are keeping the hours for their own employed jobs and then having to attend to rescues after hours, which is very demanding. And, of course, it becomes a struggle to manage fatigue. So if the right model is not established that will attract more volunteers into marine search and rescue, then in the future, as this demand increases exponentially, we will be at a point where the volunteers will just not be able to sustain the role and the service they provide the community.
Richard Burgess, Volunteer Coast Guard Squadron Board Advisor, speaking with Amy Henson. Our reporter will follow up with this story to find out what the government and the Coast Guard can agree upon. You're listening to Eye on the Peninsula with Piers Cunningham. Paramedics are upset with the increase in the number of assaults experienced on the job by people in need of medical assistance. Ray Reid updates us with this story.
Just another day for our busy paramedics doing their job to help those badly in need of urgent attention. It should be a rewarding, satisfying and relatively safe job. However, over the last 5 years in Victoria alone, the level of abuse experienced by our paramedics has increased by nearly 25%. So much so that our paramedics have had to formulate a list of no-go areas due to the high level of abuse experienced. According to the Herald Sun, the list includes over 1,200 locations. According to an Ambulance Victoria report, the two areas with the highest number of no-go zones are Dandenong and Frankston, with a number of other peninsula areas also ranking highly. The Herald Sun has reported that Ambulance Employees Associate State Secretary, Mr. Steve McGee, is seeking action which is needed to address the worrying increase in violence directed towards paramedics. But Victoria's rise in assaults towards paramedics is not isolated. In recent months, reports on increases in assaults in other states have also arisen. Only a month ago, Channel 7 Brisbane reported on increased assaults, with three assaults occurring in the one day and a paramedic being pushed 60 times in one assault on the Gold Coast. Paramedics are understandably becoming increasingly concerned for their safety. South Australia, which had also seen assaults on the rise, has already put into action a series of hard-hitting real-life TV segments graphically depicting just how easily matters can get out of control. These segments have been attributed to a decline in the rate of assaults there. Have a listen.
Get off me! Hey, Beck, what happened? You didn't see anything. It's my mate, Nick. I know him, all right?
I'll stop it
when you tell me what happened. Did he get hit in the head or what's going on?
Hey, back up.
Are you back up?
According to the Herald Sun, the list of ambulance no-go zones has tripled in some of the worst suburbs in just 5 years. Mr. McGee has said that some areas had become so risky, paramedics had raised their concerns about entering them with Ambulance Victoria management. Some of that will be drug-affected people, including ice-affected, but also a lot of it is to do with domestic violence and alcohol abuse. Health ministers across Australia are looking at a number of approaches to reverse the serious trend. Mr. McGee has called for a no-tolerance education campaign and for more people with mental health and drug issues who assault emergency workers to be charged so the courts could judge the extent of mitigating circumstances. I'm Ray Reid for RPPFM News.
A worrying situation for our paramedics who do a great job. And we will have more on the developing story from the Ambulance Employees Association State Secretary, Mr. Steve McGee, later. Ray Reid reporting. Farmers across the peninsula are uniting in their efforts of growing great food. Recently, they've been recognised for growing some of the most sought-after produce with the launch of the Mornington Peninsula Certified Trademark. Jessica Swan spoke with Mornington Peninsula avocado farmer and chair of the Food Industry Advisory Board, Steve Marshall. She begins by asking him how our peninsula farmers will be impacted by the introduction of the Mornington Peninsula Produce Trademark.
Steve, we're here today launching the official Mornington Peninsula Produce Trademark. What does this actually mean for a farmer?
Well, for a farmer, and this is probably going back a little bit, there's been a need, and a lot of farmers have expressed an interest to be able to have a umbrella-type brand where we can all try and work together to really push the peninsula produce and to also guarantee to the public that that are either tourists or shopping on the peninsula that the produce that they are purchasing is from the area.
Does it mean that you're going to get more for your produce?
I don't think so at this stage. I think that's probably, you know, we'd just like to get it up and running first. I don't think price is a market thing, but I think what it might help people is to lift the individual profile of the producers, and then from there, if their profile's lifted, then more people are coming to their farm gates, and I think it's more probably about increasing overall turnover rather than price itself.
When we see a trademark such as the Mornington Peninsula brand, many people may make the assumption that that means that it's grown in a perfectly organic way and with all of nature and the whole food system considered from a very natural perspective. But that's not necessarily the case, because farmers right across the region farm in all different ways. How does a consumer distinguish between those farmers who use chemicals and sprays and what have you against those other farmers who are taking a more of an organic or biodynamic approach to their farming?
Well, I think this is a separate issue to the trademark. The trademark itself is only a guarantee of provenance, that it's governed by the ACCC, that the produce is 100% peninsula grown. In regards to the individual farming techniques utilised, I myself am a chemical minimalist in my industry growing avocados. We have to use chemicals, otherwise our trees fall over. Or you can do it organically, but it pushes the price through the roof. In the situation of what you said before, the again it comes back to the general awareness of the consumer as to who they're purchasing from. But through our online directory, we will be linking to people's individual websites, and they also have the ability to list other organisations such as organic farming or other things that they're associated with to help build their individual brand under the overall umbrella of the MPP trademark.
Does having a trademark increase the region's potential for export markets, both domestically and even internationally?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I think we're a fair way from that at this stage. But I myself, with my business, I am looking to export. My new packaging, which has just been created, has a little box to tick for export. So, yes, I think definitely when we can go to trade shows, international trade shows as a region, to domestic shows as a region, it just gives you a more cohesive look. And you're rather than pushing one product, you can defray the costs across a group of products to promote the region.
I'm speaking with Steve Marshall, the chairman of the Food Industry Advisory Body at the Briars, where the official Mornington Peninsula Produce trademark is being launched. Steve, how sustainable can a produce trademark be when we are so susceptible to environmental conditions such as drought, for example?
Well, I know this one very well because I'm having one of the best seasons with avocados at the moment, but I know already that I have no fruit for next year. Yeah. So I've committed the ultimate branding sin of launched a new product with nothing for next year. But I know that the people who bought my fruit before are loyal, and when I come back into the market in 2 years' time, that will be there. But I think the discerning consumer understands seasonality. And again, built into the website that's associated with the trademark, lists the seasonality of each producer so that people can get an idea of what is available and when, and understand seasonality of produce better.
Just one final question. Do farmers have to do anything special in order to get that stamp on their produce?
Well, there's a fair bit of bureaucratic paperwork, so that's always a bit special to get done. But as long as your produce matches the rules, which is essentially that it's grown in the electoral boundaries of the Mornington Peninsula, you can pretty much join up our trademark.
Steve Marshall, thanks very much for your time.
That was avocado farmer and chair of the Food Industry Advisory Board, Steve Marshall, speaking with Jessica Swan. Briars Ward councillors Bev Colum and Anne Shaw met with local residents at the Mount Martha Lifesaving Club before Easter. The community meeting started with a sausage sizzle on the balcony overlooking beautiful Port Phillip Bay. This report compiled by Deborah Maher.
The two-hour meeting revealed council is not following through on safety issues at the Pillars. Parking and traffic management is a problem in Mornington. One of Mount Martha's ratepayers accused the council of duck shoving, the problem with young people drinking and littering around beach boxes at Mount Martha Beach. Attention was focused on contractors not doing their job, and the question was raised about sporting facilities not keeping up with demand. Councillor Anne Shaw touched on the problems the community is facing with young people congregating at the Pillars and possible reinforcements that need to be put in place.
The Pillars is a very interesting case where it was a hidden secret and only locals went. Since it's been publicised on social media, it's been attracting large numbers of people coming from a great distance. With that, people have been doing a lot of littering. It's about education, and it comes down to that word respect, because you don't litter your own backyard and you don't litter the natural environment. And those rules are so important, and are they being enforced strongly enough in schools? That's a big question.
The Pillars is on Crown land, and that stretch of road along the Esplanade in Mount Martha is owned by Vic Roads. The question put to Councillor Bev Colum was,
how is the council going to work together with the Vic Roads to solve this problem?
We've already started doing that. I mean, David's become quite engaged in it. He's brought it up at Parliament too, and I think that's enabled some of the signage to go through quicker with Vic Roads. There's been work done on the safety issues, and we're looking at the parking issues, mainly for the amenity of our residents, of course. It's not that we want to enable a lot of people to use the Pillars. It's the fact is that if there's a safety issue and the amenity of our residents is affected, then we need to, you know, do something about it. It is Crown land, and we're hoping that the Crown will also remove to assist us with things like signage, perhaps even correct fencing in the right places. We don't know that yet. I mean, this is a new sort of phenomenon, really. It's really taken us by surprise.
Comments raised by local Mount Martha Beach Box owner accused councillors of duck shoving, the problem, with young people drinking and leaving rubbish and broken glass. There is a risk of injuries to those who want to enjoy the beach. The solution is not easy, says Councillor Bev Collum.
As we noted tonight, it's not just Mount Martha. I mean, these things can happen in a lot of places. And we believe we use the budget as wisely as we can and spread it over a lot of kilometres of coast. We do work with the police and they do a very good job. Their numbers are limited as well. Can we police it as much as, you know, the expectation is what we heard tonight? No, I don't think we can police it to that degree. We can do educational things. We can certainly, we've been auditing the signage on our coast and make sure it's appropriate. We've worked with the police. We have a strong liquor accord. We've put bans on alcohol on some of our beaches. We've certainly acknowledged what's happening down here. Hope we can continue to progress with it.
While rate capping of 2.5% is good news, will there be enough in the budget to meet expectations of ratepayers? Councillors Collum and Shaw are concerned about the impact it will have on future projects.
We've really been working on where we can make savings without impeding any of our capital works, and we've managed to do that this year, over $2 million saved. We'll do everything we can to make sure that the capital works budget remains the same. We are still one of the most low-rating shires. We're in the lowest 10%, and we feel in some ways, you know, we're being punished for that in the fact that we now have to take on the 2.5% rise. Going to be a lot of demands, and look, we've seen this happen in other states. As much as we like to keep the rates low, 2.5 is a bit of a hard task to do. But I do believe if any shire in Victoria can do it, we will do it, because we've already put so much work into cost efficiencies. So we're a little ahead of the game.
You want to add to that, Anne?
I think the thing for me is I hate to see a generation miss out. And some of these facilities are needed today. Not in 2 years, not in 5 years, and not in 10 years. Are we going to be able to deliver things as fast as Bevan, Andrew and I would like? The answer to that's no. We'll continue to do our best with careful budgeting and making sure that the priorities stay in the order that they should be. But at the end of the day, a rate capping does have an impact. And when I look at young kids on waiting lists and no real hope to get into something within a year or two, you know, that's something missed out, and that's something that we don't like to see. So we'll keep fighting and we'll keep advocating. And I think one of the most important thing is to make sure that the federal and state governments are paying for what they should be paying. Because while they put rate capping on the shire, the cost shifting is what will impact the most on what we can deliver to our community.
We'll be taking that to all levels of government for discussion as we go along. Yeah, we've heard all about the sporting stuff. There's still footpaths, public footpaths, toilets, all of those things
and
that the community
the and the community needs that aren't infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't even touched on that tonight.
Councillor Shaw said this in closing.
We love the community that we live in, and we love advocating on their behalf.
They were some of the important issues discussed at the Briars Ward community meeting. I on the Peninsula will keep you up to date with developing Shire matters and issues. That's it for our first I on the Peninsula current affairs program. Next week's program, reporter Jessica Swan will have an interesting story about women in business agriculture on the peninsula, an update of assaults on paramedics, the Point Nepean quarantine station development, the drug ice problems in local communities, and other stories that matter to you. Hope you can tune in to 98.7 or 98.3 FM or live stream from our website, rppfm.com.au. You can also download the RPPFM app. And if you miss any Eye on the Peninsula programs, podcasts are available on our website. Thank you for listening. I'm Piers Cunningham. I'll be back next Tuesday at noon for another edition of this new program on Radio Port Phillip, Eye on the Peninsula.